Hello, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and I'm here with the Slate spoiler special on Dreamgirls. Now, remember, the spoiler special is a feature wherein we give away the secrets of a movie. So if you haven't seen Dreamgirls and, you know, you don't want to know how it all turns out, then don't listen. Although I don't know how much there is to spoil in a movie as feel-good and upbeat as this one. Joining me is Jody Rosen, who's our music critic at Slate. Hi, Jody.
Hi, Dana.
And we had the pleasure of seeing Dreamgirls together the other day, so... First off, what's your reaction to the movie overall? Enjoy, not enjoy, recommend, not?
Enjoy, yes. Recommend, definitely. Wasn't a great movie, I'd say, but thoroughly entertaining. I guess my biggest problem with the movie was the music itself. It was a little problematic to have a musical with bad music, although I guess that's sort of the norm on Broadway these days.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you more about. In your piece on the movie on Slate, which wasn't exactly a review or even a music review, but really just a reflection on this one central song, you very quickly sort of at the beginning get it over with just saying the score is terrible. And I wanted you to spend a little bit of time expanding on that, you know, as a music critic. I mean, can you get into how the score doesn't work?
Yeah, I can try. I mean, first of all, there's the issue, which I think you mentioned in your review, of there not being any hooks. That is to say that none of the songs are particularly catchy or memorable. You don't come away from the movie humming anything, really. Not even the big song in the middle. You're just kind of, you know, Jennifer Hudson's performance of "And I'm Telling You I'm Not Going" just kind of, you know, blows your mind, but it's not exactly something, doesn't leave you with a memorable tune. That's certainly the case of all the rest of the songs, which are just, you know, kind of melt into a blur.
So how is the movie so as effective as it is? I mean, it's interesting. I definitely agree with you that, you know, there's not a toe-tapping hook in there, and yet several of the songs are effective, emotionally effective, especially this big central, you know, ballad. Would you call it a ballad? I don't know. You're the music critic, not me.
Yeah, no, I definitely call that a ballad. I mean, that song is effective for some of the reasons I, you know, outline in my piece. But, you know, most of all, just because of the kind of majesty of the performance. I mean, Jennifer Hudson is incredible singer with God knows how many octaves in her vocal range and, you know, delivers this anguished but ultimately sort of triumphant song with incredible virtuosity, you know what I mean? It's this like athletic feat that you can't help but be awed by.
So the performance kind of exceeds the song itself.
Exactly, and that's the case also in towards the end of the movie. It's funny, in the film, Beyonce Knowles has to play this Diana Ross character, and of course Diana Ross famously couldn't really sing and didn't have a particularly characterful voice, and that's not at all the case with Beyonce. She's a great singer, and her voice is, you know, full of power and character, and so she's sort of, you know, restraining herself the whole time. You can kind of see her straining when she's singing. She's having to sing in this bland fashion the entire movie, but at the end she finally gets to cut loose, and this incidentally was a song that was added that wasn't in the original Broadway score, and I'm wondering whether, you know, Beyonce through some sort of fit, or I mean, you know, I just can only imagine that she demanded that there be a moment
she
in the
get
song
a diva
where she
moment
actually
too.
Gets a diva moment too, and you know, it's sort of her answer to the Jennifer Hudson moment, and you know, sure enough, it's just, you know, in technical terms, it's a mind blowing performance. It's not as emotionally engaging by any means as the Jennifer Hudson performance. But I mean, to go back to your first question, one of the reasons I think the film works, or at least is just so entertaining, is, as you say, it's very kind of luscious and lavish, and particularly from the kind of, you know, art direction, costume, set design perspective. It's just, you know, this wonderful evocation of 20 years of kind of pop culture and black music, which is the music itself is completely off. It's all sort of like vaguely cruise ship pappy pop music that doesn't really come close to approximating anything that sounds like Motown.
You were saying it doesn't even work as a pastiche of Motown. It doesn't sound like good fake Motown.
No, in fact, the irony is that they get the art direction and the hairstyles and the clothing so incredibly right. It's like, you know, perfect period pieces. But the music, which is, after all, the thing they really had to pay attention to, is just off. And one thing that really struck me funny is, you know, the irony that thematically the movie is about kind of juxtaposing authentic black music against kind of whitened, watered down versions of black music, you know, of course championing the real thing, which is embodied in Effie White, Jennifer Hudson's character. But the irony is that they're trying to do this with this music, which is written by a bunch of, you know, kind of honky Broadway songwriters who just don't know how to write an even half decent Motown pastiche. So There's a sort of problem there.
Yeah, you talked about this a little bit in your review, but we could maybe explore Jennifer Hudson's performance a little bit more in detail to talk about the question of race and authenticity in the movie. I mean, obviously, the whole movie revolves around this dichotomy, this distinction that it draws between Beyoncé's character and Jennifer Hudson's character, right? One of them being the sort of whitened, well, lighter-skinned, literally, skinnier, right? Sort mm-hmm. of more marketably beautiful, and also less soulful singer. And, you know, you and I were both talking about this kind of archetype that Jennifer Hudson embodies, which is essentially the big, fat, black woman who belts bluesy songs, and how that's always sort of held up as the icon of true American music. And so this movie is touching some very deep archetypal chords, even as it, you know, sort of turns all the music into bland mush that's indistinguishable.
Right, yeah. No, it's very funny. I mean, it's interesting to me that this movie about Motown takes such a cynical view of Motown. You know, the Jamie Foxx character, who I think is Curtis something Jr.
Curtis Taylor?
Curtis Taylor Jr. is, you know, explicitly modeled on Berry Gordy Jr., the founder mogul of Motown, who is, from all reports, a slightly malevolent figure, and certainly Jamie Foxx's character is like that. But, you know, Motown, embodied by Beyoncé's character, Dina Jones, and the music of the Dreams, that is, the Supremes, is really dismissed and kind of scorned in this movie as pap. And there's a problem there because, of course, Motown's great. Even the stuff, the most machine-produced of the Motown stuff was just fantastic. So those kind of ideas about authenticity ring a little false if you are familiar with, you know, the Motown songbook. I mean, there's that moment in the film where they have this kind of Jackson 5-like band up on stage, and of course it's a terrible version of a Jackson 5 song, but you're reminded of those Jackson 5 hits like I Want You Back, which are just so mind-blowingly good and soulful that, you know, the distinctions that the movie's trying to make just don't really ring true, at least historically.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, I guess the sort of the journey of self-discovery that the women embark on all ends with them throwing aside Curtis Taylor Jr., hence Motown.
Right.
Right.
You know, on the other hand, as I say, like, you know, the art direction is so sumptuous and the costumes are so great that it's all very seductive and enchanting, you know what
I
mean?
And the joy of performance is sort of stressed again and again, you know? I mean, performance is presented as almost pure pleasure in this movie. There's very few scenes where anyone performs and doesn't seem to be enjoying it and wanting to perform and wanting to give everything to the audience, whether it's Eddie Murphy doing his James Brown imitation or, you know, the girls up on stage doing their snaps. I mean, it's not one of those backstage musicals that has people sort of pushed on stage, you know, fearing to go on or not ready to go on.
Right.
It's a very pro-performance movie.
Right. One thing that I thought was very, very effective and kind of, you know, historically resonant was one of the first Dreams songs that becomes sort of a minor hit on R&B radio. They show, you know, rocketing to the top of the pop charts in a version by, you know, a kind of Beach Boys-esque or even cheesier.
Right.
You know, white band. I forget the title of the song, but there's this
Cadillac
song.
Cadillac Car,
that's right. Well done, Dana. My goodness, you've been doing your homework. But anyway, yeah, so there's...
Don't ask me to hum it for you, though. It wasn't catchy enough.
Can't do that. But anyway, any case, and that, you know, of course rings true because that happened time and time again. There were these songs that were, you know, R&B hits that nobody heard.
Yeah, I don't know if the movie presented that authentically or not, but it was presented as if the Dreamettes had no idea that the song would be stolen, that somebody had just simply heard it, figured out the chords, and started playing it themselves.
Right. I mean, I thought it was one of the more effective comic moments, though, the quick cut to that song.
To the uber white presentation.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the few moments that a white person figures significantly in the movie at all. I mean, something I liked about this movie is that it really was about a world of black business, you know, the black music business. And except for a brief cameo by John Lithgow as a movie producer, there really weren't any white characters.
Terrifying hair, by the way, John Lithgow with a bald-headed but long-haired
terrible period 70s
yeah.
hair. So because, as you say in your piece, essentially the movie is 125 minutes of padding around this one sort of spectacular breakout song by Jennifer Hudson, let's talk a little bit about Jennifer Hudson and what you think this movie's going to do for her, you know, where she comes from, why she's kind of a unique figure in this film.
You know, a little bit about her background. Of course, she's from Chicago, and I think she was a cruise ship entertainer, which is ironic given the fact that there was a lot of cruise ship style music in Dream.
Yeah, she sang on Disney cruises, right?
Yeah, right. She sang on Disney cruises, and I think she appeared in Big River, the musical, you know, in a local production in Chicago. And of course, you know, America first got to know her in season 3 of American Idol when she was, I think, the third runner-up. And she was, you know, a tremendous singer with this, you know, huge booming voice that you hear in Dreamgirls, and her dismissal from the show, you know, when she was voted off by the viewing public, was a bit of a shocker. And at the time, Elton John, who was, I guess, one of the guest judges on the show or something, decried this as racist. But in any case, so Jennifer Hudson's, you know, autobiography mirrors in some respect Effie White's story, because of course Effie is, you know, kicked out of the Dreams, the band that she once led as the lead singer, because she doesn't have the look. So in that way, you know, the movie's very kind of like autobiographically resonant, and I think that, you know, adds to the sort of mystique of Jennifer Hudson. And I can't imagine this film won't give her career a huge kickstart.
I had one more question, as long as we're talking about movie musicals. Mm-hmm. Do you really think that Jennifer Hudson's performance tops Judy Garland's performance of The Man That Got Away and The Star Is Born, which is the comparison we were making, this sort of very emotional set piece chunk in the middle of a musical?
You know, I kind of do.
I'm outraged. I'm leaving the studio.
Well, Dana, why don't you talk about that?
Well, I mean, I'd love to see you defend your choice. I just feel like, I mean, maybe it's just because I've seen it so many times, but Star is Born is, I think, one of the great movie musicals, and one of the great, a movie musical that manages to weave drama in a really convincing way, where you don't sort of have an artificial break of people bursting into song, and somehow the mood is just, it's just very consistent, and it's a very powerful movie for me still. And I just think that that's one of the great filmed vocal performances of all time. And much as I love Jennifer Hudson's performance in this movie, I guess I just feel like Judy Garland has an iconic power that still hasn't been surpassed by a diva to me.
You know, no, that's probably true. I guess
it's also a better song. That's my one other defense, is that The Man That Got Away is a fantastic song.
It's definitely a better song. No question about that. I think, you know, Jennifer Hudson, the whole, you know, I guess as a, I have to admit it, American Idol viewer, I'm caught up in the whole cult of personality around Jennifer Hudson and in kind of her story. So I'm bringing that to the scene.
I'm probably bringing my own, you know, great sympathy for Judy Garland's life story onto my preference for her performance too.
Yeah.
But I think that the two are definitely comparable, even in their sort of masochistic, you know, overtones. They're both songs about, you know, women just sort of laying it out there, you know, just I'm utterly lost and, you know, here's my final plea.
Right, which, as I say in my article, is, you know, that kind of is the diva tradition. Period, you know, in popular music. You hear that in Edith Piaf, you hear it in Billie Holiday, and, you know, you hear it in Aretha Franklin, the whole kind of like soul and post-soul ballad singing tradition. It's always, the woman is always in this, you know, abject state.
And as I was saying, in this movie, it has one extra little element too, which is that it's almost as if Jennifer Hudson's abject plea for love is a plea to the audience itself. I mean, since part of what she's begging for is to get her singing job back, mm-hmm. you know, and since we know her whole history of American Idol and being kicked off and so forth, to hear her sort of screaming, you must love me, or what is it, you're going to love me,
yeah.
over and over, also seems almost as if it's directed at us, the audience, you
totally,
know, and
totally.
We can't resist that plea. Yeah. So overall, over the holidays, we're sending people to Dreamgirls,
are
we?
Yeah, please.
Thanks a lot for going to the movie with me and for coming in to talk about it.
I had fun, Dana.
For Slate.com, this is Dana Stevens.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/AmicusPlus to get access wherever you listen.